The book Fire and Rain is a narrative, according to author Carolyn Woods Eisenberg, about the way national security decisions formed at the highest levels of government affect the lives of individuals at home and abroad. Her primary focus is on the way the Nixon administration fought and ended the Vietnam War. Early in the book, Hofstra University professor Eisenberg quotes President Nixon's predecessor, LBJ, during his 1964 election campaign. Quote, "We are not about to send American boys 9 or 10,000 miles away from home to do what Asian boys ought to be doing for themselves. However, the U.S. left Vietnam permanently in 1975, and at the end, the number of U.S. military personnel killed in the war was 58,098 Americans."
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach. So no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Professor Eisenberg, before we talk about your book, I want you to hear this from General Westmoreland back in April 28 of 1967.
"Given the nature of the enemy, it seems to me that the strategy we are following at this time is the proper one, and that it is producing results. While he obviously is far from quitting, there are signs that his morale and his military structure are beginning to deteriorate. The rate of decline will be in proportion to the pressure directed against him. Your servicemen in Vietnam are intelligent, skilled, dedicated, and courageous. They believe in what they're doing. Backed at home by resolve, confidence, patience, determination, and continued support, we will prevail in Vietnam over the communist aggressor."
That was in front of Congress, and he was in charge of the military in Vietnam. What are you hearing there?
I'm hearing how out of reality he was. You know, it's very interesting. I actually was at an event with General Westmoreland after the war, and he was making the point then, so he never changed in a way, that he was making the point that really we had won the war. And that the only thing that happened was that the Soviet Union had sent disinformation agents. It was never clear if he meant me, but they were sending disinformation agents into the United States and were turning people against the war so that people didn't realize how well things were going, you know, which was, this is years later. So I think he never, you know, really was the view he was, they were sabotaged, you know, on the home front, and otherwise everything would have been, you know, excellent. But, you know, part of the story of Vietnam is, as you know, not just General Westmoreland, but, you know, a whole raft of people of various levels who really were myopic. And really it's because they didn't really want to know, in a way. I mean, that the pressure for people, for example, on the ground to keep presenting positive news to the people at the next level, and for them to, you know, there was kind of a institutional lying that went on. So, you know, there was a lack of realism through the entire period.
In the intro, I read the LBJ quote, "We are not about to send American boys 9 or 10,000 miles away from home to do what Asians ought to be doing for themselves."
Well, that turned out not to be true either. Now, one of the things, so I was working on the Nixon period of the war, over and over again, when I teach about Vietnam, I have students who say they don't understand it. Like, why didn't Richard Nixon get out of the war? He could blame Lyndon Johnson, whose presidency had been wrecked, just say this was a big series of mistakes, and he's going to, you know, change the direction of the U.S. And, you know, so that was actually one of the questions that my students repeatedly asked over many years, and was one of the motivators for this book. And there really is an answer to that, which is that it wasn't a matter of Nixon and Kissinger per se. It was through the entire governmental bureaucracies, there was lying and self-deception. And for example, I think this is very important, right at the beginning of that administration, Henry Kissinger asked a very talented, relatively young man to do a questionnaire for the bureaucracies. And as it turns out, that young man was Daniel Ellsberg, who Kissinger had known at Harvard. But in any case, Kissinger wanted to get the opinion of people in the bureaucracies for a variety of reasons, including figuring out people who could be enemies, et cetera. But when you look at that, so this is now, we're talking about the earliest months of the Nixon administration. In particular, the military is really saying, we can win. That Tet Offensive, you know, regardless of how it was being reported in the media, that in fact the enemy had sustained a significant damage, which actually was true. And that there was very good reason to persevere because you could actually change the situation. So in a certain sense, for Kissinger and Nixon both, you know, to have changed the policy at that point would have been to run up against the received wisdom of the bureaucracies, and particularly the military. And that neither of those men were interested in doing that. Neither of them were that unorthodox that they were just going to defy the received wisdom.
Before we get into the book itself, tell me, when did you start? I know I saw an interview you had done with Mel Laird back in 2002, but when did you start putting this book together as a book?
It's hard to remember. I mean, I think initially I got interested in the project very much because of my students who were repetitively saying about a whole variety of things, "We don't understand this. No, this reading isn't right. How could this be?" So that was always in the background. I think I initially started this project when I was asked to do an essay for an anthology that Marilyn Young and Bob Bazanko were putting out on Vietnam, and they asked me to work on Nixon. And at that point, there wasn't, things were still very classified. We're not so quickly available. So when I wrote the essay for that reader, I was really relying on, things that were published to a large extent, whether it was memoirs or other historians or articles, whatever. But at the end of doing that and having that article be published, I still didn't think it was right. I felt like in the end that I hadn't answered a lot of things that I was curious about. So I sort of dipped into it, like, I don't even remember, like 2004, 2005. So I can't even remember at what point I was really committed to doing a book. But one of the things that was interesting in this whole process was the declassification, the availability of materials that I had never anticipated seeing. So that included, on the one hand, Henry Kissinger, when he left the White House finally, he had transcripts of all of his telephone calls. And the guy seemed to have been on the telephone like absolutely all the time, the vast number. And he claimed those telecons as his personal property. But what he did, it was still beat Trump, didn't hide it in the bathroom, is that What he did was he claimed them as his personal property. He deposited those telecons in the Library of Congress with the stipulation that they would not be open for 50 years. And then he was being sued for that. I can't even remember if it was the National Security Archive that was suing him. But at some point, his lawyers obviously told him that he was going to lose. And so one of the things what was unexpected in somewhere between 2004 and 2012 was all those telcons became available. And truthfully, some of them he had actually, you could see that he had actually doctored a few, but you know, the person's on the telephone all the time. So, you know, that's an illustration of, you know, material that's just started pouring out. The other thing that was huge that was becoming available were all the declassified transcripts of his negotiations or Nixon's negotiations with the Soviets and the Chinese. When I started my project, I didn't actually expect that I would have access to that material, but in fact, I did. And this is probably more than your listeners want to know, but it actually is interesting, which is that after the Cold War ended, the Soviet Union, or then Russia, made available to our State Department records from that period. So that, for example, when their ambassador Dobrynin met with Henry Kissinger, this ambassador would write back to Moscow and say, I had this meeting with Henry Kissinger, and you know, this is what he said, and this is what I think, and so forth. So that was kind of a rarity. And it was interesting there because when Kissinger was writing to Nixon about what happened, and when Dobrynin was writing back to to his superiors in Russia, their account of those meetings was actually pretty different. So it was challenging. So I don't know at what point I became fully committed to this project. And I also, the project really changed over time. I think that's the other thing I would say. That one of the things that became important to me, and I guess this was somewhere, you know, 15-ish, 16 years ago, is that I really wanted to write a book in which the policy decisions of the people on top could be joined to a discussion of what happens to actual people when they make these decisions. So that really complicated things, you know, considerably. But I was looking for ways to make real to readers what these choices meant. So even, you know, something as small as, well, actually it wasn't small, but when Nixon announced that he's going into Cambodia, you know, which then set off a huge, you know, explosion on college campuses. And, you know, you never read about Cambodia in that moment in history without, you know, going to Kent State and seeing that photograph. But I was really interested in what happened in Cambodia on those days, right? Which, you know, was something that kind of got lost in the Kent State shuffle. But I thought it was really important for readers of this book, not just to hear what was happening on American campuses, but to actually, you know, even just for that first week, while things are exploding here, what was going on in the villages of Cambodia. And so that whole aspect of the project made this very slow. You know, it took a really long time. And but I was really struggling through the entire process to really bring those, that other reality, you know, into focus, so that readers could appreciate not just, you know, what Nixon said to Kissinger and vice versa, and, you know, all the people they hated and so forth, which is, you know, good gossip, but that people could really, readers could appreciate what these decisions actually made, you know, what was the effect on real people in real, you know, lived in other countries. So that was really an important, you know, part of the project, and also then finding materials that could, you know, illuminate that. And please interrupt me, because I could, you know, I wrote a 500-page book and then I go on about this.
Well, hold on. Just I wanted to ask you, I take it you went to Vietnam?
Yes.
When?
I went to Vietnam, I always forget what year I was, 2000, I think it was 2010, 2011. And that's, a, you know, very important. I mean, that was, going there, and I had asked, the arrangements for that were very complicated because you don't just arrive in Vietnam and say, you know, I want to talk to this person and that. You know, everything had to be arranged through the U.S. Vietnam Friendship Society, which is a quasi-official entity. But I, you know, I asked to do interviews with, you know, go to certain places. And on the whole, they were pretty helpful. And, you know, one of the people I had asked to see was Madame Bin, who was in Paris while, you know, while the negotiations were going on. She was representing the PRG there. And she was in Paris for years. And then after North Vietnam won the war, she came back. She was Minister of Education, then became Vice President of Vietnam. And so I had asked, you know, to speak with her. And I was, you know, I just did it, but I didn't know that I was going to get that. But in fact, I did have that interview. I'd been in Vietnam for about 3 days at that point. And just talking with her was like really an extraordinary experience.
What'd you learn from her?
Pardon?
What did you learn from her?
Well, first of all, I mean, this is a side point, but interesting. It's one of the things she said to me when I was there is, you know, you're about to go traveling around. You're going to be amazed about how friendly people here are to Americans. You know, so you'll see it everywhere, which turned out to be about 97% true. And she said, you're going to wonder why that's true. And she said, there's a number of reasons. First of all, Uncle Ho always told us that the American people were not responsible for this, that this was their government. We also were acutely aware that there was a peace movement and that there were millions of Americans who wanted this violence to stop. But the third thing she said was that the number of U.S. veterans who had come back to Vietnam to do humanitarian service was truly remarkable. And she, when I was interviewing her, she had a very, very nice office that they gave her in Hanoi. And I think she was about 80 at that point. But she looked up and she said, you know, I've met a number of veterans, U.S. veterans who have come to our country to be helpful. And she sort of waved her arms and she said, you know, if these walls could talk, the stories that I heard from Americans were just extraordinary. And she said, so they... You know, there were Americans here. There have always been, you know, veterans coming back, not to do, you know, tourist things, but really to be helpful. And some of them have actually gone back to areas, especially in the northern part of South Vietnam, where a lot of Americans were, you know, a lot of destruction was there. So a lot of them have gone back to those areas, you know, to clear out unexploded ordnance and so forth. So that was really interesting. It was, I didn't really know that until when I was traveling around Vietnam, I began to learn about that. But then later I learned about it another way. So that was just kind of an interesting thing. But the other thing that she said that made sense was, I asked her, I said, look, you know, you were here for years, for several years, and you knew that the real negotiations were happening with Henry Kissinger and Le Duc Tho. And I can't remember what euphemism I used, but wasn't it boring to be sitting in Paris while the real discussions are going on some other place? And one of the things that she said was, well, part of her job was to relate to the anti-war movement and the anti-imperialist movement, the global movement that was there, that people, she was there to meet with folks from those movements and talk with them. And she said, you know, we had people from many different countries that came to meet with us and talk about what was happening and their feelings, and also, you know, Americans in the anti-war movement. So at one point, I think I asked her, well, so in a certain way, when Richard Nixon said to the peace movement, you're working for the enemy, that was not like 110% wrong. You know, and she sort of laughed and you know, and nodded. But I actually thought that was interesting because I can remember, you know, during the war, you know, various people from the peace movement would go to Paris and they say, oh, we talked to Madame Bin and this is what, you know, what she suggested to us. But I just go, I think in a way, apart from interviews that I did, and there were a number of particular things that I learned, including that conversation. was actually seeing the place. I think in a way that was the most valuable, was really that, you know, battles or incidents that are, you know, I was writing about in my book, that to be able to visualize it, or even to understand the distances between things, or, you know, to realize that that just going across, you know, the area of South Vietnam was a very narrow, you know, place. You know, I sort of thought of it as big. So, I mean, that was very helpful, I think, and just as a kind of reality check, apart from, you know, just things that different people told me.
How much of an anti-war activist were you back in those days?
Well, I was always an anti-war activist. You know, I can remember being an undergraduate at the University of Chicago, and this is going back to, like, 1963, and somebody from the American Friends Service Committee coming to our campus and giving a talk and telling us about strategic hamlets that the Americans were, you know, forcing people into. And I can still remember that talk. It was like during freshman orientation, and she was telling us this, and people were like not believing her. And, you know, then at our university, like many, the anti-war movement grew. So I was involved in that. And then when I was at Columbia in 1968, and, you know, anti-war activity, as you probably know, was very, you know, was very important on the campus. And then when I finished graduate school as a professor at Dartmouth, when the spring offensive happened, and, you know, the United States was bombing Hanoi and Haiphong, and there was a faculty organization there. So I don't feel like I was one of the leaders of this movement, but I was always a part of it. However, I guess a point I wanted to make is that I didn't write this book to defend, you know, our policies, you know, 40 years ago. I did write this book to try to understand what had happened, and to try to understand the piece of it, of not just what the U.S. did in Vietnam, but Laos and Cambodia, and how those things fit together. I did get interested. This was not a primary thing at first. I did get interested on what were the things that the anti-war movement did that were effective, that actually shaped policy, and what were the things that the anti-war movement did that were not effective and did not produce any significant results. So I didn't really even start with that question, but then when I'm reading all these high policy statements, documents, you know, I began to see that you could tell from those documents, like, what was impactful in the White House and what was not.
Did the first public official from your study start telling us either lies or non-truths about Vietnam?
Well, I think it was true probably even in the Kennedy years, but, you know, that was obviously a truncated period. I mean, you know, it's what the Pentagon Papers said. There was a lot of deception of the American public. I mean, all through, there was a lot of deception, you know, even including things which get easily forgotten, which is, you know, the presentation of the South Vietnamese government as, you know, this great democratic entity, right? And which was really the line on this, you know, when Diem was in charge and when Lyndon Johnson was in charge, they were always presenting the government of South Vietnam as really representing, you know, they are a democratic force, and they are being, you know, imposed upon the people of Vietnam, and the Russians are responsible for that, and the Chinese are responsible for that. You know, so, I mean, that was an initial thing, and then a misrepresentation of what was happening on the battlefield, et cetera. But, you know, what I want to emphasize, and this is something I really learned to appreciate when I was reading all these documents, is that what kind of gets blurred at a certain point is at what point are the people who are, you know, at the highest level of the Nixon administration, are they lying to the American people? And to what extent are they presiding over institutions in which lying is endemic, right? Because you have a whole psychology, you know, like in the military, if you think about, you know, Creighton, and Westmoreland was gone by the Nixon period, and Creighton Abrams was in charge.
The general. General Abrams, yeah.
Right. But, you know, the White House didn't really want to hear bad news. And since, you know, the White House didn't want to hear bad news, the Joint Chiefs of Staff didn't want to hear bad news. So there's pressure on the people below to misrepresent things. Or, you know, again, it shades into self-deception. But people want to hear good news up the ladder. And so by the time you're getting to Nixon and Kissinger already, you know, they don't even have access much at some of the time to really, you know, to really accurate information. There's one moment in my book, I don't know if I covered this properly, but in 1971, I realized that the situation in Laos was really pivotal for the administration. We didn't appreciate that at the time. I don't think most Americans did, but Laos was very important. And there was an operation called Lamsum 719, which was going to be the first time where South Vietnamese troops on the ground were going to do a massive offensive, or I don't know if you call it an offensive, but they were going to go into Laos. They were going to block the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And the idea was there would be no U.S. ground troops. There would just be air power that would support them. And everything goes badly almost from the very beginning. The U.S. media was embargoed. They were told that for the initial thing, they weren't even allowed to cover it. They weren't allowed to print anything. They weren't even allowed to print that they were weren't allowed to print. Literally, there's an embargo and the embargo. So you have a situation where the South Vietnamese troops are advancing and the American air power is not all that effective. So Kissinger, at a certain point, as he starts to realize, and he's slow, that this isn't going well, and he wants to understand why U.S. airplanes are not being sent on missions to the extent that he anticipated. So the question is, could he find out the weather? Because that was what it was related to, right? That he was being told by certain people that the reason there were not more bombing raids by the U.S. is because the weather is bad, but then other people say the weather is good. And so I always feel this is a moment of truth for Kissinger, where he realized he can't get people to tell him accurately what's the weather in this place. He literally can't do it, you know? And you know, he's frustrated with different individuals, but this is the whole process, right? It's not just like this is something that, you know, happens one time. It's that the whole processing of information going up the line was so, you know, was so distorted.
What was the relationship between Henry Kissinger as the National Security Advisor to Richard Nixon and William Rogers, who was the Secretary of State, and Mel Laird, who was the Secretary of Defense?
Well, that's a very good question, and obviously I have quite a bit about that, you know, in my book. The relationship between him and Rogers was terrible.
Why? Why?
Because Kissinger wanted to be in charge of everything. I mean, he felt like it was him and Nixon that were going to be the deciders. You know, they were willing to have the State Department and Rogers deal with other things, but partly there's a power struggle that is taking place. And for Kissinger, the entire 40 years, he's always maneuvering to, you know, cut Rogers out of the action and to cut other bureaucracies out of the action. I mean, one story, which I don't know if I ever found a way to tell it in an interesting manner, but that during this period, there were very important arms control talks that were going on in Helsinki. And the person in charge of that and the whole team was effectively under the control of the State Department. But in fact, Kissinger is so concerned he has a lot of concerns, but his main desire is to cut them out of the action. So the whole time that they're sitting, you know, far away working on the details of SALT, he's sitting in Washington talking to the Russian ambassador and making a different deal. And that just runs through the entire story. I mean, he just, you know, in every possible way, he wanted to get control personally. And then, you know, substantively, I think at various times, the State Department, I'm not just talking about Rogers, but the people under Rogers, at certain times, they actually didn't agree with things that the White House was doing. which would include, by the way, Cambodia, right? I mean, the State Department was not enthusiastic about doing the secret bombing of Cambodia or the invasion of Cambodia. They didn't want to do these things. And you go right down the line, you know, that when there was a choice about a more hawkish thing or less hawkish, more emphasis on diplomacy, the State Department was generally on the side of diplomacy. So there's a substantive part.
Now, what about the relationship between Kissinger and Laird?
Well, that is a really interesting question. And for me, it was one of the discoveries of this whole process, of looking at all these declassified documents, because, at the time that all these things were happening in real time, Melvin Laird, who was Secretary of Defense, was always perceived by folks in the peace movement as just another hawk, not anybody, and maybe not even so powerful, but as somebody who is really wanting to take the most drastic action possible.
Let me interrupt just to say he was a 16-year member of the House of Representatives from Wisconsin, a Republican. Go ahead.
Right. And he actually, that's not little, because, that turns out to be an important fact about Mel Laird, because he was given that job by Nixon because of his experience in Congress. That, Nixon knew that he needed a Secretary of Defense that could go up to Capitol Hill and have the relationships and the knowledge about how things work, so that when he, whatever would come up, notably the budget for defense, that he wanted somebody who could, carry that task out. And Mel Laird, who was well-liked and experienced on Capitol Hill, was somebody who could do that. But, just to cut to the chase, what turned out to be true about Melvin Laird, once I started reading, is he was basically trying to get out of Vietnam. He was not such a hawk. This is before I talked with him a couple times, but just reading the record, he's very focused on one thing, and that is getting the troops out.
Did anybody know that at the time?
Well, not in the peace movement, you didn't, but yes. Kissinger and Nixon knew that. And again, they were a little bit different, because whatever Laird was saying about a specific situation, and however annoying that might be to Kissinger, Nixon understood that he needed Mel Laird. That, in fact, Mel Laird was much more important to him than Secretary of State Rogers, because again, he needed Laird to go to Capitol Hill. And Laird would go on Capitol Hill and defend policies that he personally didn't agree with. But the trade-off was, and it was really true from, I would say, maybe 3 months into the administration, is that Laird had a trade-off. I always think of him as like Schindler, he would do what the president wanted him to do when he met congressional committees. And he would lie for the president. But he was extracting a price from the White House, and that was the removal of troops, which is something, as a person in the peace movement, every time Nixon went on television and said he was taking out more troops, everyone I knew just said, oh, it's a fraud, it's cheat, no, they're really expanding the war, they're deceiving us, it's PR. It wasn't. They were taking out troops. And by the time, something that I certainly at the time failed to appreciate, and everybody else, was that by 1972, when Nixon is up for re-election, there are no combat troops left in Vietnam. Or if there are, there's a handful. There's only like maybe 20,000 that are still there, who are people who are functioning in an advisory capacity. And, so we didn't really appreciate that, but Mel Laird did. And right through the whole 4 years, they'd be discussing one thing or another, and then Laird would say, oh, by the way, Mr. President, weren't we going to take 40,000 troops out? I think we said that by February that was going to happen. And so he was relentless. And it's my personal opinion, I don't think I documented this necessarily, but I have a feeling, particularly for Laird, that the anti-war movement in Wisconsin was very important for him. Including, his son was in the anti-war movement, although, as you probably know, many people's sons were in the anti-war movement. So I don't think it's that. But the University of Wisconsin was exploding the whole time. And then there were the electoral considerations. And that's what Nixon valued about Laird is that Laird had his finger more on the political realities in the country, but also in Congress. And, you know, one of the other things that I learned that was really interesting was, you know, back then, you know, there were many resolutions, many anti-war resolutions that were introduced, and they always lost until, you know, the war was over, virtually. And so if you were outside that, you're in the anti-war movement, you say, oh, you know, the Congress is terrible, it's a waste of time. But what you what I realized, you know, as I was reading the record, is that it wasn't just a matter of votes. It was also a matter of informal relationships, so that, you know, there are important legislators who don't necessarily vote in a anti-war way, but they're meeting with Nixon. Or they're meeting, you know, with, well, mostly with Nixon, but even with Kissinger. So you've got, you know, these legislators who are telling the president, you have to get out, regardless of what they're voting on or not voting on.
Let me interrupt, because you have this in your book that might be instructive. You talk about Lieutenant Charles Saxby, whose father was William Saxby, who was a senator from Ohio, became attorney general. But here's a quote from his son, who was at Camp Lejeune. I'm going to have to risk my life in Southeast Asia within the next year. He's telling this to his dad. Risking my life in a war that hasn't been declared, can't be fought, can't be won, a war that is contrary to everything I've been taught to believe about America. Where did you, do you remember where that came from?
I don't remember. I think probably, I actually don't remember. I mean, there were so many declassified files, you know, that I went through that it's actually hard to like pinpoint where that is. But I knew, or maybe it's even possible that it was in the congressional record.
How much of this kind of thing did you find where sons of people in power were, I mean, I remember one particular senator whose son took out an ad in a newspaper opposed to his father in the war.
Do you remember who that was? I'm curious.
Somebody from Colorado? Don't remember?
I think it's very, I don't necessarily, I mean, actually the Kennedy administration, was even in Johnson administration, was, you know, more extreme case of that, where you had, you know, Craig McNamara, who was very anti-war. You know, Dean Rusk's son was very anti-war. The Bundy sons were very anti-war. I think it probably, you know, with more intellectual types in the Johnson years, there's more sons that are making trouble. But even, I think even Agnew's daughter was, you know, became involved in the peace movement, at, you know, at some point. So there is that generation.
Let's go, though, to your whole issue about the difference between people in power and the people weren't in power and what they were seeing, say, in Vietnam, or their families were seeing in Vietnam. And you say there was never a connection there. I mean, I think you made one comment about Nixon and Kissinger never went to the Chu Chi tunnels that you saw in Vietnam. They have no idea what it was like.
Well, right. I mean, that was, in a way, one of the things that was most startling when I went to Vietnam, was the physical place. Like, you look at the Chu Chi tunnels, which are, like, vast. And and there's levels of the Chu Chi tunnels, and people are living there for months on end. That was also true, not just there, but there were also tunnels in Quang Tri province that were very substantial as well. So it was, in some sense, and then going to the Mekong Delta was very interesting in the same way, like, because you look at these things and sort of their physical embodiment, and you realize how difficult this situation really is. Like, what, you're really going to pacify the Mekong Delta? You know, I had imagined it, you know, from television, gray, whatever. But, you know, when you see it, it's different. You know, the question you're asking is really important. As I indicated earlier, one of my important goals for this, which came a lot of ways out of my teaching, was doing not just policy, but then looking for ways to communicate the impact, and therefore trying to find out more about what was going on in the ground in these various places. And, you know, I could talk later about the sources that I used for that. But So I was really doing that initially because as a teacher, I had realized over the years that students are not all that interested, well, most students are not that interested in policy when it's disconnected from everything else. And the Vietnam literature is very split. Like there's people writing personal things or, you know, collectively personal things, and then policy and those things are separate. So that was a big goal for me, was to connect them. And I thought it'd be more interesting. But what I really ended up learning, you know, going through this, is how little the situation on the ground, it had so little reality for the people who are making policy. That they're not interested when there are news journalists who are on the ground in Laos or Cambodia who are wanting to, you know, to tell what they're seeing. You know, Nixon and Kissinger and the rest of them, you know, they just regard it as intrusive. Like, why are they writing this, you know, these stories? They hate Anthony Lewis because Anthony Lewis occasionally goes places and sees things and reports on what he sees.
New York Times reporter.
Right, right. And they think of him as like this horrible individual. But what I began to understand in a sort of at a different level was their unwillingness to learn what was happening on the ground was part of why they made bad decisions. And when I'm saying bad, not just in a moral sense, but, you know, but bad, you know, in that they were unwise decisions, and that was repeatedly the case, because they couldn't learn. And it's not just this is not just a book about two men, actually. I never figured out a good title, because it's really about a lot of people. I mean, how these institutions really operate was that the reluctance to find out things really compromised, you know, how they thought about things. You know, there's one, so I didn't do a million interviews, but I did do some. I was really interested in talking to journalists, particularly who were there. But they consider these journalists just subversive and mean and malicious. And there's, you know, one of the things I have in the book, it's just incredible to me, is I have a section in the book that's about Hamburger Hill, which is like, you know, pretty famous. There was a movie about it, which I deliberately did not watch because I wanted to learn it myself. And so, you know, this is this battle which made absolutely no sense. The North Vietnamese are on top of a hill, and this lieutenant keeps ordering his men up the hill like 9 times, and more of them get killed. It's totally pointless. And so what happens is two of the soldiers that are on Hamburger Hill and survived are interviewed, I think, on CBS. And they describe what they had been through, and their friends were killed. So these two soldiers, as they're describing what happened to their friends, start crying on CBS. And so what is the reaction of the White House? You know, you might find it interesting or morally relevant, or just even knowing the morale of our troops. You know, Nixon's response is, how come the army let these people go on television? Right? I mean, that's what it, why did they go on television? That was a mistake. And of course, that whole attitude again, I mean, one of the things that lack of interest, which is in almost, you know, really is at an institutional level. It's not just these two people and, you know, what they think, but, you know, it just runs through this entire story. And so what they don't know, for example, I mean, they know a little of it, but not really, is what's happening to our troops. Right? I mean, that's another thing they didn't want to know about.
Let me go to your teaching.
Yes.
How long have you been at Hofstra?
I was at Hofstra for, I can't even tell, maybe 29 years.
Explain what the university's like and where it is.
It's on Long Island. It is a pretty vibrant place. It has, you know, a strong undergraduate population, and then it also has, you know, law school and now medical school and engineering school. So it's actually a very dynamic place, you know, in a lot of respects. And the students there are really a mix. I mean, now there's like all these crazy stories about, you know, how hard it is to get into Yale, you know, like 1%. You know, and Hofstra is not particularly selective in terms of the student body, which I actually think is a strength. And then there's a wide range of students, you know, some of them very academically skilled, others not. Our job is to make everybody skilled, right?
Talk about teaching the Vietnam War to students. How much do they know when they walk in your classroom, and what, you know, and you say this book was written for their benefit. What are they going to learn specifically after that semester is over?
Well, I can't, you know, of course, we never know what they learn, you know, what happens after the semester is over. I mean, one thing that's really important that is a big change is when I first came to the university and taught about Vietnam, I had, you know, numbers of students in the class who were in the class because their parents, their fathers were veterans. And so, you know, it was not unusual when we went around and people introduced themselves. You know, you know, students would say, you know, I've taken this course, my father won't talk to me. Right? I mean, that was really very common. And, you know, students would say, well, I feel like if I'm studying this, and, you know, maybe my father will find this interesting, or, you know, and as we go through the semester, sometimes students would say, well, my dad just read the book that we just did, or something like that. So that was very specific, really, in terms of that, you know, for a number of years, the presence of students like that, you know, was really valuable in the class, because they brought a kind of intellectual energy to the process. I think I can't really, you know, really authoritatively say what they took away. I had, you know, but, you know, when I said it in the book, I mean, part of the way that students impacted, you know, my writing was just the questions they kept asking. Right. I mean, so, it, you know, and because the questions were good questions. Right. And I didn't have answers for those, you know, starting with question one, which is why does Nixon and Kissinger go on for 4 years with this thing that's a flop, really? But, you know, bottom line, it's a flop. That's a student question. Another question that students had, and they were, you know, there are always answers, but some answers are really not that persuasive. Was the students are interested in why are you having this war in Southeast Asia, and meanwhile you're making deals with the Soviet Union and China? Like, what in the world is that about? How to explain? You know, and so again, it's not, we had readings in class, but a lot of students were dissatisfied with that. In terms of the takeaway, I think maybe the biggest takeaway is for students to understand that policy decisions have real life consequences. And that when they're reading a newspaper, which back then I have to say they did, now it's terrible. I mean, I think the situation is just terrible. I mean, my students are just not reading the news, or they're getting it from TikTok, you know, or you know, Twitter or whatever. So this is very different, you know, it's a very different time. But you know, I would say, like, my goal was always as a teacher, it's not, I didn't want to persuade students of anything, really. I wanted them to get the habit of thinking for themselves and being knowledgeable and knowing that policy is not an abstraction, that policy really matters for people. I think that would be what I care about.
On page 476, you make this definitive statement. America's Vietnam War was a failure. How often have you run into people that take you on and say, you don't get it, we were not a failure? And I know you mentioned Westmoreland earlier.
Right, so Westmoreland, I would say my interaction with Westmoreland was not a useful conversation for either of us. I don't really run into it very often. Now, again, you know, maybe who I'm teaching, but We did one of the things we did on our campus for various reasons, like, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, was we had a whole series of events on Vietnam. And we included as part of that event, veterans speak out. We were going to have like a speak out. And I, in trying to build that event, did not want to just have it be an event with, you know, there are plenty of anti-war vets who are, or, you know, who are still even now in an organization. So we reached out to them, but I very particularly didn't want us to be just one side. So I, you know, also reached out to various veterans programs on the island, you know, people whose views I had no idea about. And, you know, tried to get, you know, a wide variety of veterans that would come to campus and talk about their experiences. But I would, so I didn't handpick people to be critics. But I would say, you know, pretty overwhelmingly that that these veterans, maybe they didn't even necessarily have a view about how it came out. You know, that was not exactly what they wanted to talk about. They more wanted to talk about their immediate experience. And, you know, for some of them, the immediate experience is that they're mad at anti-war people. This thing about people spitting at them is like ridiculous. But there's a deeper point, which is that people who felt, you know, criticized and undermined by domestic dissent. That was real. But mostly what these folks wanted to just talk about was like their experience, what happened to them personally and what that was like. And they weren't very interested in having like a big discussion about the ultimate outcome.
What was your reaction when your alma mater just gave you the Bancroft Award? And what is that? I know it's a $10,000 award. Mean anything to you?
That I got the award, or the fact that there are police arresting students on campus?
Either one.
Either one. Happy to get the award, a little incredulous. I mean, back in 1968, one of the concerns that students had was that the university was expanding into Harlem and therefore, you know, taking housing away from the community. So I received my prize, you know, in what used to be Harlem, right? Because the university is moved in a, you know, in a very massive way. And it was a lovely prize, and it was, you know, all the people involved in it were just incredibly gracious and kind. So, me personally, you know, it was really a good experience. The fact that they were arresting people down, you know, nine blocks away, I thought it was terrible. I saw the, you know, the accounts of the Columbia president's remarks on Capitol Hill, I guess 2 days ago, which I feel as though she started out, you know, strong with some recognition of the complexities. And then she started, under the pressure of that questioning, she, you know, became more and more, you know, telling them what they wanted to hear. I think the arrests, you know, and the students probably organized this event to coincide with that, you know, appearance by the president. And she, you know, and I'm sure some of her response to their protests was because she had just promised all these people on Capitol Hill that there would be a crackdown. One of my thoughts is how stupid this was, you know, because like what happened at the university in 68 and can happen now is you get cops on campus and they're arresting people. And, you know, then more of the campus gets alienated by the presence of police. So that's certainly what happened at Columbia. And 68 was, I mean, they arrested about 1,000 people. I was actually one of them. And then, you know, partly the one thing that happened in 68 that I don't think happened here was the police riot. Because, I mean, something that's not understood about 68 was like, if you were in a building, except where students were resisting arrest, but if you were in one of those five buildings, the police were pretty okay. I mean, my husband and I were in the building, and police were, you know, we had a very nice arresting officer. It was, you know, there was nothing unpleasant. But what happened was the cops, that not so much the cops in the building, except at Lowe, were rioting on the campus. They were beating up kids who were not in the buildings, which was really ridiculous. And, you know, so that, of course, set the whole campus off.
What happened to you when you were arrested?
What happened was, this is contrary to the stereotypes. My husband and I are both arrested in a space in Fairweather where there were hundreds of us in Fairweather, and we were all people not resisting arrest, and we knew that we were going to be arrested. We actually had a lovely police officer. I mean, he was so nice that at some point, because there was a women's jail and a jail for men, women's jail was very crowded because they arrested, I think, like 400 women. But at some point, that arresting officer was in the prison and told me that he knew there had been some violence involved. And he wanted me to know that my husband was fine. So I thought that was very nice. I mean, so I actually think the experiences were very varied. But, you know, a lot of the police were very rough. And, you know, in Low Library, they were very, very brutal with kids. And
Low's the name of the library. Low.
Low is actually not the library. It's called Low Library, but that's where the administration was.
The big building there in the quad.
Right.
Go back to what you said earlier, that there were lessons learned, that, in your opinion, good and bad, about what activism, what works and what doesn't work. Could you go back to that and tell us what you think works and doesn't work?
Well, you know, it's probably less cut and dried than I'm saying, but I feel like I learned a lot from those declassified records in terms of what was having an impact. And I do think that some of the very extreme behavior by demonstrators, this is not going to come as a revelation, but some of the more extreme behaviors that went on, you know, were damaging because it made other people in the society feel, you know, here are these privileged students and they're, you know, behaving in such an outrageous way. But even there, even with the things that were violent and that actually annoyed people, it was a little bit of a mixed bag even there, because it also contributed to a sense that our society is coming apart because of this war, and it would probably be a better idea not to have that going on. So I would say some of that militant activity is much more, you know, that's double-edged. What I realized more was the importance of congressional opinion and of activity involved in, you know, in pressuring members of Congress, that all that legislative work, that the electoral politics, that it was actually more effective than I appreciated at the time. And, you know, that, you know, I think to a large extent, if you were in the anti-war movement back then, one of the things that was very pervasive was the feeling of, oh my God, these horrible things are happening. Americans are dying, Laotians are dying. And everything we're doing isn't working, right? It's just like a failure. And, you know, if I could give you one extreme example of failure, of what felt like a failure, would be the McGovern campaign, right? That, you know, in the anti-war movement, the more mainstream activity was to work for a peace candidate in the Democratic Party.
This is in 72.
This is 72. And so, you know, there was all this work for George McGovern. And then you had an election in which he, you know, it was a total flop, right?
What did he win? One state?
I think he won Massachusetts, right? So the conventional wisdom, you know, in the anti-war world is, well, this is an example of how stupid electoral politics is. But what I start to really understand reading the record is that McGovern was a lot more successful than we understood, because he changed the Democratic Party, for one thing, right? The people that were candidates who were rivals to him, like Hubert Humphrey and Muskie and people like that, who, you know, had not been very strong about the war, that the entire party moved into an anti-war posture as a consequence of the McGovern candidacy is very, very significant. And it also, in any event, that was one thing. Another thing that happened as a result of the electoral activity that I think nobody I knew paid any attention to is that in that election of 72, there were some more anti-war senators who were elected. So what does that all mean? Well, one of the things that meant is that I would say a week after Election Day, some of the most conservative senators, I want to say Tower and Stennis and maybe Gerald Ford, they go up to Capitol Hill and they say to Nixon, we don't have the votes. Understand that when we come back, when Congress, the new Congress comes in January, there will be no money for Vietnam. At this point, Kissinger is, you know, in Paris diddling around. So you need to make it clear that we have to have a peace agreement because there will be a cutoff of the war. So that was certainly something I didn't know anything about. I think I didn't give a thought, or nobody I knew, did, to the fact that maybe two more anti-war senators were, you know, had been elected. It seemed like the least significant thing. And the other piece that we missed, and again, I think this is very related to electoral work and to Congress, even Congress that doesn't ever really pass a good resolution, is the removal of troops. Because partly what Laird, and this is where Laird is kind of a linchpin. I mean, essentially what Laird is saying to Nixon is you've got to bring the troops out. You've got to start doing that. You know, or you're politically, you know, you're going to end up like Lyndon Johnson. And so, you know, there was a poll taken right at the time that, you know, that election with McGovern. Americans were asked, who do you trust to end the war more, Richard Nixon or George McGovern? And people said, overwhelmingly, Richard Nixon. And I remember, if you're in the anti-war movement, you're saying, oh my God, the American people are so stupid. Like, how are they tricked like this? But actually, we were tricked. Because what Americans were seeing across the country was troops were coming home. Nixon brought them home, which is what Melvin Laird told him to do, right? So, you know, whatever rhetoric is getting shared in the actual campaign, and, you know, again, the McGovern candidacy was a pressure in that direction. You know, you're living in a little town in Ohio when there's five kids that have been in the military and they come home. And that's a very important thing. And you don't care about anything else.
As you know, in the book, I mean, at the top during the Lyndon Johnson administration, 550,000 American troops. And then at 20,000 at the time that Richard Nixon was elected, or right after, I guess by 72.
Right.
What do you think? Well, let me ask you two things and then we'll wrap it up. One, what is your personal analysis, not necessarily about the war, but of both Kissinger and Nixon? What do you think of them?
I think they were very intelligent. I think they were emotionally very damaged people. Obviously people who, you know, for whom power was the important thing. The lack of sensitivity or interest, again, in just like finding out anything about people. I mean, it's just extraordinary. But, you know, one of the problems that I really had writing this book, and I don't think I settled it at all, is so they are the deciders. In the end, they are the deciders. And that's why they have to be centered in the book. But it's not just them. And that's really an important point in the book. I mean, when, you know, going back to the very beginning, when they first come into office, you want to recognize that as smart as they were, whatever, they're also conformists. Nixon didn't get where he was by challenging any orthodox thing. And neither really did Henry Kissinger. These are people who know how to, you know, get along with other people in power and so forth. So when they come in and they're being told by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for example, oh, well, if we only do X and Y, we could still, this could be a victory. They're not that critical of that. They're lacking in a certain kind of critical sensibility, as smart as they are, because they are taking, you know, what is conventional wisdom in the bureaucracies and basically acting that way. Now, they change over time. I mean, so that's a whole other longer story. And part of why they change is that they're mad at the bureaucracies, because they're getting stuck holding the bag. You know, they take their advice of the military, and then, you know, something goes wrong. And so over time, I mean, they go from thinking that, you know, General Creighton Abrams is the most brilliant person in the world to really deciding he's an absolute fool. You know, so that's over time. And so they become themselves more skeptical about things that they're being advised to do. So there is that change.
Go ahead, finish your comment.
But no, I mean, they're hostile guys. You know, there's ways that two of them, this is like terrible psychologizing, but I had this discussion with Stanley Cutler at one point, who got the tapes released.
The writer, Stanley Cutler, right, yeah. Right.
So, you know, sometimes you read the conversations they have, and they're like two boys in junior high school who are like, don't like all the other kids, and, you know, are like, you know, have a sort of crazy combination of grandiosity and weakness. So, I mean, there's a lot you could say about their personalities, but it's not about personalities, really. It isn't. It's not because they're stupid, because they aren't. It's about how our institutions work and the conventional wisdom. And that's really what this story is.
Last question. What is, in your opinion, the impact of the Vietnam War on the country since then?
And the country since then, it's a really good question. I think there's sort of cliche things you could say about it, in terms of that there was, I think, you know, a national reaction against military adventures, right? You know, that it was going to be less easy for an American president to commit U.S. troops to, you know, a difficult situation. So I think you had that. But, you know, honestly, I feel right now, you know, this is probably colored by, I think, the Biden administration's terrible mishandling of what's happened in Gaza. I don't know that there's like durable lessons. I mean, durable lessons was to the Pentagon to control journalists, for example, right? They said, you know, in Desert Storm, and, you know, then the invasion of Iraq, and, you know, they put much more restrictions on journalists, so journalists couldn't go. You know, also wherever possible, it's better to bomb places than to send troops there. You know, there were all those kind of lessons, but. You know, but have we, you know, as a country become more sensitive, more interested in what U.S. policy is doing? Are people now watching the U.S. government arm Israel while they're slaughtering civilians? And is our country more alert and sensitive to that situation? I don't think so. It's horrifying. So in that sense, it's sort of reminiscent of the early days of Vietnam. Who cared about Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, our own troops? No, it'd be nice to say there were all these lessons learned, but I don't know that the important ones were really learned.
The name of the book is Fire and Rain, Nixon, Kissinger, and the Wars in Southeast Asia. Our guest is Hofstra University Professor Carolyn Woods Eisenberg. We thank you for your time.
And thank you for your wonderful interview. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Book Notes Plus podcast. Please rate and review Book Notes Plus, and don't forget to follow so you never miss an episode. Questions or comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.